This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. In 2005, I quit my job for the chance to float down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon in a wooden boat called a whitewater dory. You can't float the Colorado through the Grand Canyon in a wooden dory without knowing about Martin Litton. Martin Litton was a conservationist and an adventurer who is credited with the audacious feat of preventing the Grand Canyon from becoming a series of mild cascading reservoirs. He also perfected the flat-bottom drift boat that is now known as the Whitewater Dory into what he thought was the exact right shape for the rapids of the Grand Canyon. Dories are graceful but unforgiving. I saw a boat with its bow cracked clean off on a beach in the Grand Canyon. A note said R.I.P., the Pima, and detailed her last hours pinned between a cliff wall at the bottom of Horn Creek Rapid and the surge of the Colorado Current. The oranges that fell out of her busted open hatches could be found floating in eddies below most rapids for miles and miles downstream. We were halfway through the trip, and it was one of the more sobering moments of my life. This was Martin Litton's chosen mode of transportation down the river. Sleek, fast, curvaceous, gorgeous. He started a tour company called Grand Canyon Dories that took clients down the river in this way. Dories ride high on the tops of waves. They turn on a dime. They are the race car to the rubber raft's bulldozer. To understand the appeal of the boat of Litton's choice is to understand a bit about the man himself. He was a firecracker of a conservationist. He was a relentless advocate for wilderness. He was a daredevil with a cause. Martin Litton died around this time last year at the age of 97. In some ways, he left his legacy in the form of the Colorado River itself as it flows undammed through the Grand Canyon, but he also left his fleet of boats, one of the most exciting and adventurous ways to see the bottom of the canyon.
The river has a tremendous force. It has an appeal about it that I can't describe. But when you have people in a boat, to sense a kind of the life that the river has. It's mind-expanding, for sure.
That's Martin Litton in a new short documentary called Martin's Boat, about a new dory built in the year since his death.
How's the boat look?
Yeah.
It looks like a piece of artwork. Built this boat in memory of Martin Litton because he deserved it. I couldn't be happier. Tell you, I was a little worried that I wasn't going to get this thing done. To the last minute, got her finished.
Pete McBride is a filmmaker who lives in Colorado. He made the film Martin's Boat with Oars Rafting, an outfitter that owns and manages Martin's fleet of dories and takes people down the Grand Canyon in Martin's style. He followed this new boat called the Marble Canyon on its maiden voyage through the Grand Canyon.
The most recent boat is named Marble Canyon. It was built in honor of Martin Litton. And Marble Canyon is a place that is thankfully due to his fiery soul, that it remains undammed.
I should mention that all of Martin's boats are named after places that have been lost or are threatened with being lost.
So these boats are like little reminders are like little signature pieces that not only give great adventure rides, but they also remind us of places that we should think about. The film is about its maiden voyage down the Grand Canyon, seeing if the boat builder, Duffy Dale, can actually get it through unscathed without hitting a wall or a rock or flipping it. And so it was about that boat that she spent 5 months building. And there's a giant photograph of Martin emblazoned inside the hatch. So it's about that boat, but really it's symbolically about dories in general because he was the champion of the dories. It's also just a highlight of this remarkable place called the Grand Canyon, this open-air cathedral that is really unique to this planet and is sometimes often overlooked and in many cases, particularly today, is getting squeezed and pressured from all sides. People are looking to turn its beauty into cash in some way. There's been proposals to put trams from the rim of the Grand Canyon down to the river. There's increased pressure for uranium mining on the outside of the park's border. There's increased tourism helicopter traffic. There's increased development. And all of these threats to the Grand Canyon, they don't seem to be going away. And in some ways, we need more Martin Littons in the world.
I agree with you that we need more Martin Littons in the world, but are these tourism threats the same as the threats of a dam? I mean, is it that serious?
I would say yes. You're not going to flood the canyon with water, but you're going to flood the canyon with people. And I believe everyone should have the opportunity to see the Grand Canyon. It's the seventh wonder of the world. It's how we see it and how we go about that. So a tram that would bring 10,000 people a day, not only inside the Grand Canyon, but to what the Navajo consider their sacred lands, what the Hopi consider their sacred area. In some ways, you know, 10,000 people a day, it, even if everyone goes down with their best intentions, we have a tendency to litter. There's a huge problem of where the water comes from, how you deal with sewage, and all of this would be challenged down 4,000 feet below the rim at the confluence of the Little Colorado and the main stem of the Colorado. Of course, it's the Navajo's land that the tram originates from, so it's ultimately their decision, and many that I've spoken to believe that it would be a travesty. They want to keep their sacred land sacred and untouched, so their future generations and even those that have not seen it in this generation can see it as their ancestors did.
So in order to make this film, Martin's Boat, about the river and about the Marble Canyon, you actually got to go on a dory trip down the Grand Canyon. What was that like? We should probably mention that when you're in a human-powered boat, it's a really long trip. This wasn't just like a weekend getaway. This was a full-on expedition.
No, it was a 14-day trip. It was actually a commercial trip. So there was two families, a bunch of friends and families, mostly from the Northwest region. They were warned that there was going to be some silly filmmaker tagging behind in a raft trying to document this story, and they were keen. And then some of the boatmen, of course, were like Andre Potochnik is one of the longtime boatmen down there. He has a PhD in geology, and he worked with Martin Litton for years. Duffy Dale is a younger boatman, but he's run the river about 160 times. He built the Marble Canyon by hand with some help of his other boatmen. He grew up basically in the shadow of Martin Litton, so he didn't know him very well. He was just a tyke running around the boathouse. He was basically raised in the boathouse when Martin owned it. So there's a real family spirit and element with some of these boatmen that have been running it for years. And, of course, the stories of Martin, a guy named Moki is a great boatman, too. He did many trips with Martin, and each night we'd stop and camp, and he'd love to bring out the gin to toast Martin. Martin's favorite cocktail was gin, and they would rehash great stories of some of the crazy antics of Martin Litton. Usually take the craziest line through the rapid, and somehow they say, you know, as it says in the film, he had an angel on his shoulder. He didn't flip somehow. Kevin Fedarko is an author who I worked with on the film. He did a book called The Emerald Mile about the fastest dory through the Grand Canyon. He was privileged to be to sit in the bow of a dory on Martin's last run through Lava Falls, which he rode at age 87. Which, now having done my first run down Lava Falls, is just mind-boggling to me to imagine that he did that in a dory at age 87, but gives you a little insight into the spirit of Martin Litton.
Have you heard the story about Martin going down lava, flipping, hiking back up, getting in another boat, flipping, hiking back up?
Oh, yeah, that's actually Crystal Rapid.
Oh, it's
interesting. Further upstream, and he did it. He was so afraid of anybody getting hurt that he was going to row all four boats, but he rowed three of his four boats down Crystal, and each time he flipped, somehow swam the boat to the shore, walked back up, and repeated it because the rapid was raging and it was in a violent state. And he kept, I guess, thinking he was the only one who could do it. He couldn't. Finally, his fourth boatman, or one of his boatmen, took the fourth boat, and I can't recall if he flipped or not. I think he did flip. So all boats flipped on that trip, and that was just sounds like one of many average runs of Martin Litton.
Did you get to ride in Martin's boat?
I did. I got to ride. I rode one rapid in Martin's boat, the Marble Canyon. Duffy was rowing in a rapid called Upset. And ironically, that was the one rapid that Duffy nearly flipped in. There's a big couple waves at the bottom, and they surge a little bit, and this one stood up and basically just crashed right over the boat and buried us.
Closed out on us, and it just went right over the bow and completely submerged the boat. If I wouldn't have high-sided, we would have been in the drink, swimming. Upset. It was good.
Old Martin smiling inside the hatch.
Yeah. Letting go of the oar, the high side, and the oar.
So there's a comment about Martin speaking from the hatch there. I think that was, maybe one moment he was rumbling down there or giggling. Who knows? To give you a little perspective, these dories, they're not, this Marble Canyon boat is new. It's had 4 runs down the canyon now, and all of them have been golden runs where they haven't hit a rock or flipped. But some of the boats in the fleet that are still going down there today were Martin's original boats and have been rowing the Grand Canyon since the early 70s. So it's like going down the river in old wooden antiques on some level. If only those boats could talk, I guess. The stories are pretty endless.
Did you stop on at the proposed dam site and see the blast holes?
Yeah, we did. We actually went about 200 feet, 300 feet into the cliff. There are these tunnels inside Marble Canyon on both the north and south rims, river right and river left, and they go in for hundreds and hundreds of feet. You just can't believe it. They were basically boring holes to test the rock to see what how they would do this dam. I've walked the upper rim where they actually had a camp, a whole settlement. They had a tram that they built up when they were originally planning to do the dam. And it's all left there. Nobody realizes there's this giant industrial wasteland on top of the red wall. It's about 1,000 feet up is the remnants of this man camp. And it just shows how intent they really were on building this dam. They were well along their way until the public started sending dump truck loads of letters to Washington, D.C. and the Bureau of Reclamation. It was a significant fight that was, in some ways, it was a David and Goliath story.
It makes it feel like it was kind of saved in the nick of time.
It seems like it. Having walked and seen some of the development up on that rim, which you never see when you're on the river, you realize what the kind of investment they put into it. And to be clear, Martin was just one of many passionate people back in the day that fought this. He wasn't the only one. But thanks to his passion, he convinced David Brower to really pursue this battle. David Brower called Martin Litton his conscience. And Martin passionately stood up at a board meeting for the Sierra Club and convinced them that they have to fight the Marble Canyon Dam fight, have to put everything they have into that fight. Today, we're grateful that there's no dam, though. We don't have a reservoir in Marble Canyon. And what would have been tragic, in my opinion, is that not only would you have had a reservoir in this remarkable canyon, is that the river below it would have been turned into just basically a symbolic trickle. It wouldn't really have been a river.
Your film is fairly short. It's like 24 minutes or so. What did you have to leave out? What got left on the cutting room floor?
What got left? Well, it was an ongoing kind of struggle editing. There have been films that have been done specifically just on Martin and his life. So we tried to look at Martin kind of flowing with the state of the boatmen that are alive today carrying on his tradition. And of course, this new boat that's named and built just for him. But I left out other elements, some of the challenges happening in the Grand Canyon. We're trying to keep it not be too political. But we kept some of those out of it and just tried to highlight some of the beauty in the boat world. And of course, the American public's attention span seems to be getting shorter and shorter. So that's the reason for short films.
Are you going to make another movie about the Colorado River after this?
I don't know. I've made a few. I think that was my third or fourth film about the Colorado River.
If people can't make it to a film festival in the winter, is there any way that people can see Martin's boat?
Well, there's. I believe we're just talking about how we're going to release it online. We haven't figured out the exact date, but there's a website, martinsboat.com, and that has all the info, and we'll list all the releases coming up. all the theatrical film fest stuff, and also when we do it online. And right now you can read about it and see a trailer. That's a good place to start.
Well, it's a beautiful film, and thanks so much for making it and for talking to me about it.
No, thank you very much for the time.
Pete McBride, he's a filmmaker and a National Geographic photographer. His film, Martin's Boat, hits the film festival circuit in January.
River Trip is sometimes, it's been called the voyage of life. It is a microcosm of life. The challenge isn't so great at the beginning, and then it develops and develops, and you find yourself able to cope with it, and finally you've done it. You've done the whole thing.
Even though Martin Litton helped stop the dam in Marble Canyon, we all know that there are plenty of other dams on the Colorado, not a single one of them without controversy. After a short break, The Source's Ross Chambliss talks about the fate of Lake Powell, which is the name for the water that's impounded behind Glen Canyon Dam. Stay tuned. Lake Powell was created over 50 years ago by damming the Colorado River and flooding what was Glen Canyon. At the time, Glen Canyon was relatively unknown, but many believe it was beautiful enough to be its own national park. Now Lake Powell is a place for recreation and a source of energy and water storage. Utah state officials hope to tap the reservoir to nourish a growing population, but others say it's already tapped out and doomed because of climate change. The Source's Ross Chambliss spoke with two people advocating two very different actions with Lake Powell, two people named Eric.
Okay, first, meet Eric number one.
Eric Millis. I'm the director of the Utah Division of Water Resources.
We're in Eric's office, tucked way back in the Department of Natural Resources building in Salt Lake City. From here, his agency, a staff of around 40 people, have been working out the options for a Lake Powell pipeline, how it would draw water from the west of the lake near Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which routes it could take to move the water 140 miles to the west, how it will access the power it needs to pump the water uphill along one stretch, and where it will finally take the nearly 86,000 acre-feet of river water to the Sand Hollow Reservoir near Hurricane, Utah. There, the water could nourish Washington County's booming population, one that the Utah Governor's Office says could quadruple to nearly 600,000 people in 50 years. Millis's division recently submitted a preliminary licensing proposal for a Lake Powell pipeline to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
We have collected a lot of information. We've got that out there. We hope that the public and the agencies will look through that and give us the feedback that that they've got for us so that we can move ahead with this.
Eric has been thinking about this project for a long time. He became director of Utah's Division of Water Resources in 2013. Before that, he worked for the division for 25 years as a civil engineer, working on various water development projects across the state. His agency will submit a final proposal by April 2016, and then it'll undergo a two-year NEPA environmental impact review. In the meantime, they'll also need to figure out how much the pipeline will cost to build. Right now, the figures range from $1.5 to $3.2 billion. And those costs are contentious, especially since project critics, including some economists, doubt Washington County residents could ever really repay the state to recoup the costs. They argue that their water rates would have to be so high that Washington County residents would be better off conserving or finding other options rather than tapping Lake Powell to get their water. And then there are those who have serious doubts that Colorado River will have enough water in coming years to justify a Lake Powell pipeline. And that brings us to Eric number two.
My name is Eric Balkin. I'm the executive director of Glen Canyon Institute. It's really part of a greater movement that grew out of anger that Glen Canyon Dam was built in the first place. We are a science-based advocacy group. We've worked hard over the last 20 years to educate the public, facilitate scientific research, and influence smarter water policy in the West.
Eric Balkin grew up reading Edward Abbey books and floating the Colorado on river trips so often when he was young that he's now a fervent advocate of the West's most important river and the stunning canyon that drowned beneath it. He says Glen Canyon Institute doesn't actually advocate for removing Glen Canyon Dam, but it's not something they're opposed to. What Eric Balkin says they really want is for water managers to abandon Lake Powell, let Glen Canyon restore itself, and to fill Lake Mead first.
The purpose of Lake Powell is to harness excess water and deliver it to Lake Mead to fulfill our legal obligations. And currently, there isn't enough water in the entire river system to fill either one of those reservoirs. So they were built to catch excess water, but the days of excess are over, and it just doesn't make sense to have two half-empty reservoirs when we could fill one.
Balkan says filling Lake Mead and draining Lake Powell would actually increase the amount of water in the system. Lake Powell loses a lot of water to ground seepage, unlike Lake Mead. So filling Lake Mead could save up to 300,000 acre-feet of water by some estimates, the same amount used by all of Nevada each year.
We've heard that proposal for many years. We don't agree that it's a good idea.
This is Eric Millis again. This notion, as you might expect, has lots of critics, most of whom are current water managers at federal and state levels. Eric Millis is among them. He says draining Lake Powell could hurt the tourist economy. It would remove a source of renewable energy, the Glen Canyon Dam, and it would impede managers from stabilizing flows in the Grand Canyon.
If you took Lake Powell offline, you would take almost half of the storage on the Colorado River off. And to the upper basin states, to the lower basin states, to Mexico, that doesn't make any sense. And so there are a number of consequences that would come from that. First of all, it would require a significant rewrite of the law of the river in order to even make that work. But we believe that that would make the upper basin states, Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Utah, more vulnerable to shortages from drought. It would also make the lower basin states more vulnerable to shortages from drought, just because that storage is important to them also.
Draining Lake Powell would obviously defeat the purpose of a Lake Powell pipeline. And Millis pushes back, saying keeping Lake Powell and building the pipeline could actually help withstand climate change because it could help capture rainwater all year long. But Eric Balkan and others who study the potential impacts of climate change say the Colorado River is in real trouble. Studies by the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, Stanford University, and the U.S. Geological Survey all indicate that growing demand on the river by water users, diminishing precipitation, and increased evaporation from high temperatures will eventually undermine Lake Mead and Lake Powell unless something radical is done.
Why does the Division of Water Resources in the state believe that the lake will be reliable enough to go forward with this pipeline?
We've had the Bureau of Reclamation do modeling for us. The Bureau of Reclamation really is the expert on the hydrology and the operation of the river, and they have used their models that they use in operating the river to assess the impacts of climate change, additional development, including the Lake Powell pipeline, and those sorts of things. And as they have done that, they have shown that except for the very most extreme conditions, there will always be water in Lake Powell for the Lake Powell pipeline project. And so we feel confident about that, that they have, as the experts, looked at it, modeled it, tried to cover all the bases, including climate change scenario, and see that there is still water for the project. Now, people look at the level of the lake right now, it's down almost 100 feet. We've been through almost 15 years of drought now, and with that, we had a few good years in there. 2011 was a great year. 2005 was a good year. There have been other good years in there. But Lake Powell has performed very well, I think, in the face of that many years of drought, to be drawn down that only that amount.
I have a hard time believing that. It seems a little too simplistic to me.
Eric Balkan again. He says pipeline critics also point to Bureau of Reclamation studies to argue that the lake will not perform well. Balkan says this reflects the delicate relationship between the federal government and Western states. Even though the feds know there isn't enough water in the system, he says, they can't legally tell any state not to develop their water. Even cautioning a state not to could be interpreted as federal overreach.
I think when we're talking about the Lake Powell pipeline and diverting more water from the Colorado River, which is already overtapped as it is, we really need to look at the big picture. The Colorado River Basin is in a water crisis. We are seeing a systemic water shortage right now. And I say water shortage and not drought because calling it a drought implies that it's temporary and this is going to go away in a couple of years. And the truth is that the Colorado River Basin states actually use more water every year than flows in the river. this is why Lake Powell is at 50% full. This is why Lake Mead is at 38% full. This last year, Lake Mead dropped to its lowest level since it began filling in 1938. This last year, we also saw total storage on the Colorado River drop to its lowest level in history. If you look at the big picture, we are seeing a river in decline. That is to say that we're taking more water out than flows in the river. To build a massive pipeline that will cost Utah billions of dollars that relies on this depleting resource, I think is totally irresponsible.
In many ways, Eric Balkin and Eric Millis represent two very different tribes operating on the Colorado River. One tribe has long sought to manipulate and engineer the river to perpetuate growth and prosperity for the West's growing population. The other tribe seeks to free the river from that controlling mindset and instead accept some limits to our growth. This side wants Western water managers to adopt a more holistic, Western-wide strategy for the river, and they say we need to learn to be better at conserving water. With plans for the Lake Powell pipeline moving forward, questions are routinely raised as to whether Washington County and St. George have really done their part to conserve water, first and foremost to building an expensive Lake Powell pipeline. The Washington County Water Conservancy District says residents there use about 120 gallons of water per capita per day, which is about on par with other southwestern cities. Eric Millis.
They have seen a 26% reduction in per capita water use since 2000. And you'll remember that the state goal is a 25% reduction from 2000 to 2025. And so Washington County has already met that goal, and there's still things that they could do more.
One thing cities there like St. George could do is implement more steeply tiered water rate structures that could send price signals to water users to use less. Conservation advocates say raising the price on water is really the best way to see real conservation happen. Still, lower basin states like California and Nevada are already taking drastic steps to cut their water use. Las Vegas residents, who get 90% of their water from Lake Mead, have high monthly water costs, and even water police, who levy fines to yard-watering wasters. Las Vegas City aims to get its average per capita per day water use number down to 90 gallons by 2020. The Lake Powell pipeline would divert about 6% of Utah's Colorado River compact allocation. But some speculate that if Utah builds its Lake Powell pipeline upstream before taking similar conservation actions, lower basin states will throw a fit. But Eric Millis disagrees.
The allocations allotted to each state through the Colorado River Compact and all the documents that are associated with that is really what governs how much water each state gets. And Utah has a particular allocation, and the other states do also. And each of those states expect to use their allocation. Utah's right there also. And so there's an agreement among the states. They understand, they realize that each state has an allocation that they expect and intend to use. And that's all based on the law of the river, as they call it, which is the Colorado River Compact and many, many documents that are associated with that.
That logic is business as usual.
Here's the other Eric, Eric Balkin.
That's the way it's always been done. And the way that you capitalize on your water rights is that you build, you develop. And that's just kind of the status quo. But I, you know, again, I really got to argue that that is not going to take us into the future in a sustainable way. You know, by using up every last drop of our legal allotment, we might be capitalizing on our legal use, but if there's not enough water in the river to supply that in the future, we could have to make some really hard decisions. So we're seeing this in the lower basin, right? Arizona and Nevada are already preparing for delivery cuts from Lake Mead. There's nothing to say that that couldn't happen to us in the upper basin. We may have water rights on paper, but we already know that there are more paper water rights than physical water in the river. Mm-hmm. So they're not wrong in that assumption. And a lot of the state legislators refer to it as our birthright, you know, to use that water. And it's true. And it's a reasonable explanation for wanting to use up that water. But it does not address the fact that there is likely not going to be as much water in the future. So, you know, we could see some really bad repercussions from using up every last drop of our water. We could see conflicts between Lake Powell pipeline water versus Central Utah Project rights. Native American rights. other agricultural water rights within the state, they could become, they could enter into conflict with one another should our water situation change. And beyond that, there could potentially be even water battles between the upper and lower basin. We don't know. I mean, there are rules laid out to some extent that dictate this, but they don't anticipate those reservoirs being as low as the science says. So based on the scientific projections, the reservoir levels that could exist in the future, there really isn't a legal structure to deal with that.
Both Eric Millis and Eric Balkin have starkly opposing ideas for how we should manage the Colorado River in the climate change age. Each passionately believes he knows the right approach to meet the needs of the future. One Eric sees more concrete, steel, and engineering confidence as the solution to a warmer, drier, more crowded future. The other Eric says those old approaches haven't worked and won't work to keep the river vibrant. He says we need radical new ideas, beginning with an acceptance of our limitations in order for us to maintain our affluent lifestyles with less water. Regardless of whichever side you might agree with, Utah will need to reach some solution for Washington County fairly soon. And whether the solution ultimately involves greater conservation, a Lake Powell pipeline, or no pipeline at all Utah residents would be wise to pay attention. Your participation in this discussion could influence the ultimate outcome. For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
Because we're holding back the Colorado River in these reservoirs, and because of all of these so-called straws, the pipes and pipelines that allow us to draw water out of the river to use how we please, the river actually runs dry about 100 miles before it reaches the sea. But last year, conservation groups and government agencies played matchmaker, and they actually connected the Colorado River to the Sea of Cortez in what many people, even scientists, called a kiss. The story of that kiss after a short break. Gary Walkner heads a nonprofit group called Save the Colorado. I met him this summer, not at the headwaters of the Colorado, but on the upper part of the Green River, which is a major tributary. We were thinking about what happens to the water we were camping next to, how it makes its way into Utah, watering the melon patches in the desert before disappearing into the Labyrinth and Stillwater Canyons that back up behind Cataract Canyon, where the Green meets the Colorado proper. The big dams are still ahead, as is the Grand Canyon. Morelos Dam on the border between U.S. and Mexico is the final nail in the river's coffin, where what's left of it, what belongs to Mexico, is siphoned off into a tube and sucked away from its channel. In this story, Gary's talking about the very end of the line. He was 40 miles downstream from that dam last March, standing in the Sandy Delta in the middle of what was supposed to be the Colorado River. It was 100 degrees, and this cool breeze started coming down the channel ahead of a small trickle of water.
And it would come over your feet, and it was moving at maybe 2-3 miles an hour, and you could walk right along beside it. And it would come over your shoes and your feet and just rise up your ankles. You stood there for 30 minutes. It was the most incredible experience to see this river come back to life. And it literally smelled like the Continental Divide in the place in Colorado where I know it. It was cool. It was still cool on my ankles. You know, after it had gone through 90 miles of like 100-degree desert sand, and it was still cool on the feet and you could smell the mountains in it.
For Gary to stand in ankle-deep water 40 miles downstream from Morelos Dam, a major international agreement had to be signed and a half dozen environmental groups worked around the clock for years. That trickle, called the pulse flow, represented less than 1% of what used to flood the Delta every year before the dams. On March 22, 2014, the gates were opened on Morelos Dam, allowing this bubble of water to spill into the dry Delta. During some high water years in the late 90s, this happened on its own, but really the dry disconnect between the river and the sea has been in place since the 60s. Obviously, this has had serious implications on the fisheries in the Sea of Cortez. They're gone. And on the unique desert wetland of the Delta, which sounds like an oxymoron, but really it's a rare and wonderful ecosystem. It used to be one of the most biodiverse places in the United States, and the hope of the organizations that pushed for the pulse flow was that maybe just a little bit of water could perk up an ecosystem that was dormant rather than dead. The Nature Conservancy was one of the organizations involved in the pulse flow project. I talked to Brian Richter, the chief scientist for their global water program.
There are a surprising number of rivers and streams around the world now that are literally being dried up for human use. And the Colorado River is no different. By the time you get to the tail end of the Colorado River, its delta, where the river once flowed into the Sea of Cortez, the Gulf of California in Mexico, it's now all dried up. For decades, water hasn't flowed through the delta. No connection to the ocean anymore. And a lot of people say, well, so, you know, what's wrong with that? Shouldn't we keep, isn't that a waste of water to let any water run to the sea? Well, it turns out that that water flowing into the ocean and into estuaries that are at the mouth of these rivers is very, very important to fisheries production and all the livelihoods and economies that are associated with that. And so the Colorado River hasn't reached its delta for decades. And there's a lot of people that have been very concerned about that, what we've lost. This was one of the most important wetlands in all of North America. It was a 2-million-acre wetland full of waterfowl, ducks and geese. And this is hard to imagine because the delta is totally dry. There used to be a fish there called the Totoaba that would grow to longer than 6 feet in length and more than 100 pounds in weight. And you go out there today and you say, how in the world could that have possibly happened? So it was a very different place prior to, say, before we started building Glen Canyon and Lake Mead, Hoover Dam. So there's been a lot of interest in trying to bring some water back to the Delta. And a few years ago, I think it was 2008, 2009, there was a big earthquake in Mexico, in the Mexicali Valley, and it shattered a lot of the infrastructure that was used for irrigating crops there. The canals, the pipelines, and that sort of thing. And so the Mexican farmers were in real dire straits. So there have been negotiations going on about how the United States could step in, under what terms, and help to finance some of the rebuilding of that irrigation infrastructure. As part of that deal between the two countries, the two governments agreed that we would invest in rebuilding the irrigation in Mexico in exchange for some additional water use rights within the United States. So we would store some of that saved water by making those farms in Mexico more efficient. We would save some of that stored water in the lower reservoirs in the Colorado River on the United States side. As part of those negotiations, a number of environmental groups got involved, including the Nature Conservancy, and advocated for using some of that saved water, some of that new water that was available to the United States and Mexico, to reconnect the Colorado River with the ocean and to improve the fisheries and the livelihoods there. And so a year ago spring, so in March, April, May, June of last year, of 2014, there was some of that saved water was stored up in the reservoir, and they released it in what was called the pulse flow, and the river reconnected to the ocean again for the first time in decades. And it was a really inspiring celebration. There were pictures of Mexican kids who had never seen water flowing down the Colorado River, even though they lived in villages right on the banks of that river. And the towns just sort of shut down, and there was a one big party for weeks on end of not just the kids, but the parents coming out, riding horses up and down the river, just celebrating the return of water. And we've already seen that the environmental benefits, the ecological recovery of that delta system, has shown some signs, some very, very positive signs.
When the Colorado River breached Morelos Dam last March, filmmaker Pete McBride was there too, with his camera and a stand-up paddleboard. Even though it was only a few inches deep in places, he became one of only three people who have paddled the Colorado River to the Sea of Cortez in recent human history.
How was it? It was probably one of the hardest bushwhacking journeys I've been on. Definitely on a paddleboard. There was some real thick sections of mesquite and tamarisk and cattails, mostly little pockets where agricultural water had leached into these kind of low spots in the delta, enough just to support little pockets of really dense vegetation. And the mosquitoes were biblical. I've never seen anything like mosquitoes that emerged. I'd walked the delta 2009, 2010, and there was no water, and of course, there were no mosquitoes then, so it never dawned on me that they were, it crossed my mind that the mosquitoes would come back with such ferocity and anger. Beyond that, beyond the challenges, it was spectacular on so many levels. The ecological memory down there just seemed to spring right back to life. We saw these crustaceans that were swimming in the sand within minutes of the pulse. It was called the pulse release. Life was just coming right back to life. And a lot of the willows and cottonwoods were spawning. And so you had this cotton and seeds floating in the air, and the birds were going crazy, and the coyotes. And it wasn't what Aldo Leopold, the great conservationist who canoed in 1922, saw. He took a canoe across there and talked about these the cottonwood forests and the leopards and the green lagoons everywhere. We at points saw these green lagoons that you couldn't figure out how to negotiate, and it was pretty magical to see that. But we didn't see it to the extent he did, but we got a glimpse of what that place was like and could be like. And it was, and more importantly, it was to see the spirit of the Mexican people down there. They had everyone down at the river shore, the mariachi bands, the ranchero bands, the taco carts, the dune buggies, the dancing horses, all the cowboys on the horses, people fishing, kids running, playing. It was like this joyous fiesta, and they were all celebrating their rio, their river, you know, celebrating the special guest of water, which they hadn't seen in. The last time the river actually reached the sea was 1998, so it was nearly two decades. So that was, for me, one of the greatest sights. I just couldn't believe.
After seeing the delta like that, do you feel differently when you're upstream from there on the river?
I do. I think about I just think about rivers differently now. I, like many, started this project. I had no clue what became of the Colorado River. I had no idea it dried up until I walked across it. I had no idea how significant a delta was down there, what these estuaries really, how important they were. And now I have a small glimpse into it, and I realize how these rivers are really arteries connecting so many of our systems that keep things going on this planet, wildlife and also us. It's not just about hearing, you know, endangered species of birds singing. It's about keeping salt out of our water table so we can have grow farm, you know, food on our farmland. There's a lot of interconnected systems through rivers that we often overlook.
All three of these guys who were involved with the pulse flow talked about how hopeful the project made them. There's something really satisfying about the thought of a river running its entire course from source to mouth. Because rivers like the Colorado seem so massive, so almighty, so endless. But they can die. We can kill them. I asked Brian Richter of the Nature Conservancy if this was going to be a one-off event or if it could happen again.
We're sure hoping that it will. So that agreement was for a 5-year pilot program. And the agreement was to just do one pulse flow in that 5 years. There's now very active agreement or very active negotiations going on to try to make that a permanent situation. So every few years to do that kind of a pulse flow. We're very hopeful that that's going to get it put into place because of how well received this first experiment was. At the same time, that same group of environmental interests, 5 different conservation organizations, both in Mexico and the United States, have banded together to raise funds to purchase water rights from willing farmers that will enable us to actually run a trickle of water down the river all of the time. So the river will be flowing all of the time, and then every once in a while getting a pulse flush coming down. So it's very, very exciting, and I'm very optimistic.
Now if I had a Mexican hat, I wouldn't put it on. I'd jump right in from its broad brim and skim down the San Juan. And if somebody made for me a good old gooseneck pie, I'd rather float on down his throat in a riverboat, says I. Oh, 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 muddy river, oh, oh, on your way down to the sea, I'll take your rapids and your roar like they ain't never been took before, and come a running back for more, 'cause you don't worry me.
The Source is a production of Utah Public Radio with major support from iUtah. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. I produced this episode of The Source with help from Ross Chambliss and moral support from Ryan Cunningham. There were a lot of stories we could have told about the Colorado River this month. Special thanks to the folks who made time to talk to us about their relationship with the river. Filmmaker Pete McBride, both of the Erics, Eric Millis and Eric Balkin, Save the Colorado's Gary Walkner, and the Nature Conservancy's Brian Richter.
Send our flood down to the sea. I'll meet you there for a big party. We'll bust out Boulder Dam. Then Leahy built a ferry there.
We're back next month with one last episode of The Source. There have been a lot of developments in 2015, the year of water. Ross and I are planning on bringing you some updates on stories we reported on earlier this year. If you have a request for a story you'd like to hear more about, send us a tweet using the hashtag UPRSource, or send us an email to uprsource@gmail.com. Refresh your memory at upr.org, where all 11 episodes of The Source are archived with full audio. Talk to you then. Thanks for listening.
Just crash along with me. The mules work hard at Phantom Ranch, but the deer are really living. Just have a seat and a buck will eat all the buckwheat cakes you'll give them. At Toro Weep I went to sleep a-dreamin' of an actress. In great despair I woke up there, the air gone from my mattress. Oh, muddy river, oh, on your way down to the sea. I'll take your rapids and your roar like they ain't never been took before, and come a running back for more, 'cause you don't worry me. At Lava Falls, the roar appalls and no words can define it. We stood on shore for a week or more and swore that we would line it. No guts, I heard a boatman say, as down the tongue he rode it. He pulled ashore with a broken oar some 40 miles below it. Oh, Danger River, boiling, seething, turning to the sea. Your rapids took me and your roar like I ain't never been took before. I ain't so sure I want some more. A Christian you.